The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Tropical hot dog night.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dave's Gone By. 90 minutes of talk radio, comedy, music, interviews, and more, coming to you live from the White House lawn, cleverly disguised as a rundown radio station in Merrick, Long Island. Now, this is a brilliant counterterrorism move, switching the White House for WTBB. Instead of world-class furnishings, the whole place has been decked out with soundproof tile, shabby paneling, there's an old wooden table, some file cabinets. And the president is safe. He's having a fine old time. I heard him joking with Colin Powell that now and then he enjoys roughing it. And certainly he's over in engineering now trying to learn how to work a DAC machine. No, Mr. President, don't blow into it. All right, Mr. Cheney, could you help the president's tongue out of the... Yeah, I knew we should have started him on something simple like sorting CDs. Anyway, we're managing great here. There's round-the-clock food service. Round-the-clock Secret Service. No sexy interns, unfortunately. Those all went out with the Clinton administration. There's more than one reason the interns here are all nicknamed Bush babies, but gosh, they're very helpful. And if you're worried about national security, don't be. Donald Rumsfeld is back at the actual radio station. He's in Merrick, and they're rigging the mini-disc players to fire missile discs. The microphones have also been outfitted with special Star Wars technology that allows the CIA to listen in on private conversations within a 50-mile radius. I thought they'd be tuning in on mosques and stuff, but for some reason, they've got it tapped into a girls' high school locker room in Port Jefferson. I'm not sure what the security risk is in that, but the Secret Service guys are nodding their heads and rocking back and forth, so it must be something good. And there's also Army guys at the station, and they're using the antenna to track Bin Laden's movement. Basically, they can track him as far as the station's signal reaches. So if Osama gets within a quarter mile of the Welcome to Merrick sign, we're on hand. Anyway, welcome to Merrick, and Freeport, and my show, Dave's Gone By. I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, journalist, theater critic, and political animal. And every Sunday night at 7:30, my show aims to be an eclectic mix of smart talk, silly talk, musical excursions, and more. Included in that more is this disclaimer. My program is rated DGB 13. That means I will probably say 13 tasteless or disgusting things over the next hour and a half, which you might not feel makes appropriate listening for young kids. Nothing remotely obscene or FCC 21, just some talk about sex, death, war, fire, fraud, Satan, and most disturbingly, Scrabble. And speaking of pushing the verbal envelope, my wife was watching Public Access a few nights ago, and I'm very happy about this. Cablevision of Long Island has traditionally been terrible about the public access programming it provides. And I did a whole segment weeks ago ragging on Cablevision for raising the rates and for having such poor selection, but I have to say, they did do something very cool. When they switched all the channels around in January, they moved the public access channel down from 70 to 20. Which really changes the whole profile of the station. I mean, if you're shuttling between the major networks and Turner or USA Cable, you're going to pass this channel many times over. So between all the slick new dramedies and sitcoms on the lower numbers and all the vintage repeats of dramedies and sitcoms on the upper dial, here's this original homemade programming. Most of it is awful, technically deficient, impenetrable, a lot of crappy gospel shows. Wait, that sounds vaguely familiar. Anyway, seriously, a lot of the dreadful stuff, though, is still fascinating and real. A lot of high school kids, of course, Saturday Night Live sketch wannabes, which is fine. I confess to being a weekend update wannabe. And you'll find all sorts of intriguingly eccentric people. Blind guitar players, retirees and their pets, shut-ins and their train sets. I mean, where else on the dial do you get a Zenbach? Or Cablevision's legal nemesis, Glendora, God bless her. I don't even have to watch their shows more than once a year. I'm just happy they're on. It feels like democracy in action. And Cablevision used to suck because their rule for getting public access studio time, which residents are legally entitled to, were really onerous. They were essentially geared to keeping as many people off the air as possible, rather than allowing a variety of races and classes on the air. But we all know what's happened with digital cameras in the last couple of years. Suddenly, everybody has access to equipment that can take video of marginally acceptable broadcast quality. And you're seeing it, including stuff that isn't broadcast quality. And all of it has more value to me than another HBO or home shopping channel. I really need to do a whole long piece on public access, but the reason I brought it up tonight is that my wife was watching a week or so ago, and there was this program on at 11 p.m., and there was this fat, kind of doofy guy driving a car, and he's talking to the camera, and he's using the F word a lot, and they're not bleeping it or silencing it over. He's like, I gotta go to the F in this and F that, and she is out of her F in mind. And I think he used a couple of other bad words, too, but that one was pretty constant. It was mammoth language. And then the other night, they had an urban fashion show, basically amateur models walking down not so much a runway as a makeshift hallway in some Econo Lodge. And there's a crowd, and the clothes are nice. And then I'm watching these models go back and forth, and suddenly they start playing a rap song, and every fourth word is mother F, and every fifth word is nigger. Leaving aside for the moment the message being sent to the African-American community by parading scantily clad black women across a vestibule while post-gangster rap is playing. Again, all the words were coming through loud and clear on my Optimum cable, and one assumes on basic cable too. So I don't know what the rules are now for public access, or public access on Cablevision specifically. So if someone does, please email me at davesgoneby@aol.com. I'd really just be curious. And I'm not complaining about the language. On the contrary, I hope it's legal and fits the broadest definition of community standards. I remember the very early days of cable in New York City, when after 11 at night, it was a free-for-all. Everyone from Ugly George to Midnight Blue. It was pretty shocking and weird at the time, and however titillating, seemed of a piece with the decadent spiral that New York City was sucked into in the late 1970s. In retrospect, however, it was also sexually liberating. No brown paper wrappers, no men in raincoats, no grimy topless joints. It was softcore, tailored first for 7th Avenue, then for suburbia. The unheralded bridge between the rise of Playboy and Penthouse in the 50s and 60s and the home video revolution that brought porn into the bedroom in the 1980s. Whether Cablevision will ever allow that on basic cable is debatable. But I do hope that after 10 or 11 at night, it can speak more freely and use a few blue words. I hope that the shows we saw on Channel 20 weren't a mistake. They weren't tapes that accidentally sneaked by, unscreened by cable management. Hopefully they were acceptable content within the parameters of free expression. All that said, much as I would like the freedom here to play the occasional song with an unbleeped four-letter word in it or use the S or F word for comic effect, be assured that I make a strenuous effort not to use those words on this program. And only rarely do I go for cheap laughs by using words like hooters, balls, nuts, stoop, gazongas, pee-pee as a verb, pee-pee as a noun, wang, schmuck, putz, and ocarina. As I said, this is not a program for children. It's a show for grown-ups who want to feel like children. Or, if you're Michael Jackson, a grown-up who wants to feel children. Well, so many of my recent programs have been theme shows. Everything from Groundhog Day to Australia Day to Valentine's Day to my dad's birthday. And those have all been cool. And just wait 2 weeks for our St. Patrick's Day Purim spiel. That's going to be really frightening. But tonight, no special theme, no intricate interconnected tissue, just an old-fashioned Dave's Gone By show, which means I can move freely from music to talk to interviews to anything I want, all held together by whatever personal charisma I can muster. We'll have the news gone by, of course, with a special tribute to Mr. Rogers. Later, I'll turn all Dick Cavett on you and share a Groucho Marx anecdote. And also, we'll have a Dave's Gone Cultural segment I planned for 2 weeks ago when we were snowed out. Finally, we can do it tonight, a chat with Richmond Shepherd. Now, if you're a longtime radio listener, you might remember that name. He was a movie and theater critic on the late-lamented WNEW-AM radio about a decade ago. He's also done a zillion arts-related things in his long career, including performing with his mime troupe, owning a chain of theaters in L.A., and producing shows off-Broadway and in cabaret venues. Well, there are a million things I could interview him about. But tonight, I specifically wanted his take on Attorney General Elliot Spitzer's call to eliminate the so-called building fee that places like Madison Square Garden and Broadway theaters put on each ticket. It's the extra dollar or two they tack on for restoration or renovation of the edifice. Landlords say it's necessary to maintain their property. Spitzer calls it scalping. We'll hear what Richmond calls it later in the show. Oh, and this just in, Tampa Bay 10, Oakland 3. More on that later. So stick around for tonight's edition of Dave's Gone By, and we'll begin our forward march right after this. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on WGBB AM 1240 Freeport. It is 7:48 p.m. and time for our weekly segment, The News Gone By, news and events of the past week from a party-pooping partisan perspective. Well, Americans breathed a mild sigh of relief this week when the national threat of terror was officially lowered. Al-Qaeda is still a danger, but with the Holy Hajj over, the likelihood of imminent attack is just slightly lessened. Therefore, the national alert has moved from code orange to yellow. Why the color yellow? Wait for a real terror threat, then check your underpants, and you'll know. In business news, it's a smackdown for the World Wrestling Entertainment Complex in Times Square. The building, including a theme restaurant, TV studio, and retail store, will close in April, more than $18 million in the red. Experts told Newsday the venue arrived at a time when theme restaurants, such as the defunct Harley-Davidson Cafe and the All-Star Cafe, were on their way out. Customers would come once for the novelty, but once they saw the high prices and mediocre food quality, chose not to return. And we all know what happened to the tourist trade after 9/11. Asked what he planned to do after the World Wrestling restaurant closed in April, the maitre d' said, "If I'm going down, I'm taking the escargot with me, but I'll be coming back, and I'll make all you vegetarian pansies kneel at my feet and eat the crumbs of my perfectly grilled Chateaubriand." In separation of church and state news, school officials in Buffalo, New York, reversed a decision about the kinds of candy kids could sell to raise money. According to the Associated Press, administrators felt that chocolate crosses and candy Easter eggs were a little too religious and exclusionary for a public school. They actually sent out catalogs with "not available" stickers pasted over the crucifix-shaped chocolates. But they changed their minds this week and reversed the ruling, allowing students to sell Christian-related sweets for the holidays. I think it's a wise decision, though I wonder if the candy company did go a little too far. For example, its red licorice is billed as being good to the 39th lash, and its milk chocolate Hands of Jesus mold comes complete with oozing raspberry center. Another school-related item, congratulations to Alex Goldman and Daniel Stoll of Solomon Schechter Day School in Commack. They won the regional Scrabble Championship, beating 5th through 8th graders all through Nassau, Suffolk, and Queens. Their winning word? Zirams, Z-I-R-A-M-S, which is an organic salt farmers use to keep fungus off crops. How they knew that, I do not know, but Goldman and Stoll now get to travel to Boston for the national finals, except for one problem. The 2 6th graders are both Orthodox Jews, and the Scrabble tourney falls on a Saturday. Organizers say they can have proxy players do the physical work involved in Scrabble, picking up the tiles, writing down the scores, but the kids would still have to think and calculate the scores on their own. Rabbis are being consulted about the dilemma, with the principal of another Jewish school telling Newsday, quote, "It's not a simple yes or a definite no. This is one of the tougher calls." It's understandable that kids who study both Hebrew and English would win at Scrabble, since they're used to reading words both backwards and forwards. And I think it's fine if they go play on Saturday, because if they just stay home and go to synagogue instead, their minds are not going to be on prayer anyway. as soon as they start saying the Shema, they'll be like, V'chol levavcha u'v'chol nafshecha. Oh my God, that's a triple word score! Okay, and here is the bad pun of the week. What do a lousy pool player and an unlucky Scrabble player both have in common? The answer? They're always stuck with a useless cue. Yeah, that pun was brought to you as a public disservice by Dave's Gone By. If you'd like to sponsor the Bad Pun of the Week, and God knows why you would, but if you would, just contact me at davesgoneby@AOL.com, and for just a little bit of money, you can have your name attached to that horrible stench. One more piece of religious school news. After months of petitioning, the Kentucky Mountain Bible College has finally gotten its area code changed. The last time the phone company revised numbers, the school wound up with 666. Yep, the mark of Satan that, according to the Book of Revelations, gets stamped on people's hands and foreheads before they're damned for eternity. The college finally got its wish and is now at area code 693. While the whole thing's rather silly, I do understand. I always felt a little creepy, honestly, passing the Tishman Building on Fifth Avenue with its big red 666 on top. They finally got rid of that logo in 2002 and replaced it with CITI. Meanwhile, located at United Nations Plaza, Trump Tower also has the Mark of the Beast, but only when Donald Trump is actually in it. More fallout from the fire at the station, the Rhode Island nightclub that burnt to the ground, killing 97 attendees of a Great White concert last week. The club owner will face a grand jury and have to prove that his noise insulation was properly fireproofed and that the room wasn't overcrowded. Workers at the club will be asked why they didn't say anything when it became obvious the band was setting up pyrotechnics. One employee said he was surprised to see so many flares, kerosene jars, and Sterno cans at a heavy metal concert, but he just figured the heroin would get there later. On condition of immunity from prosecution, lead singer Jack Russell has agreed to testify in front of a grand jury. He'll be asked whether or not the band cautioned the club owner that they would be using pyrotechnics. He'll also be asked why, after all these years, the band still sucks. The band's guitarist has already been fired. Well, fired at 3,000 degrees.
We play these parlor games. We play it make-believe. When we get to the part where I say that I'm gonna leave, everybody loves a happy ending, but we don't even try. We go straight past pretending to the part where everybody loves to cry. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks. We saw we're safe as houses. They're not so spectacular, they don't burn up in the sky, they can dazzle on a light. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. You were the spice of life, the gin in my vermouth. Though the sparks would fly, but our love was fireproof. Sometimes we'd fight in public, darling, with very little cause. But different kinds of sparks would fly when we got on our own behind closed doors. Indoor fireworks can still burn your fingers. Indoor fireworks. We saw we're safe as houses. They're not so spectacular. They don't burn up in the sky. They can dazzle autumn light. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. bound to tell the truth. These things have to be faced. My fuse is burning out. All that bound is gone to waste. Don't think for a moment, dear, that we'll ever be through. I'll build a bonfire of my dreams and burn a broken effigy of me and you. End of fireworks. Can still burn your fingers. End of fireworks. We swore as safe as houses. They're not so spectacular. They don't burn up in the sky. Vacant as a heart alight. I'll bring a tear when the smoke gets in your eye. When the smoke gets in your eye. When the smoke gets in your eye.
In entertainment news, on Monday, CBS TV debuted its mid-season replacement sitcom, My Big Fat Greek Life. The network, of course, expects that the unprecedented success of the movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, will carry over to a TV show as well. In fact, to cash in on the movie's popularity, CBS is creating or revising several shows. Their schedule will now feature such programs as My Big Fat Greek Bachelorette, Everybody Loves Big Fat Greek Raymond, Touched by a Big Fat Greek Angel, The Bold, The Beautiful, The Big, The Fat, and The Greek, and for variety, 60 Big Fat Armenian Minutes. Not to be outdone, the other networks have come up with their own spins on this franchise. NBC, first out of the box, with My Big Fat Greek Friends and Dog Eats Big Fat Greek Dog. With ABC, the Greek themes are a bit more subtle. Their shows include Anal Alias and The Rear View. So pervasive is the influence of Nia Vardalos' movie, CBS is actually retiring its famous logo of an eye. They've traded it for a more appropriate tie-in, a coffee cup with a picture of the Acropolis on it. In further entertainment news on Dave's Gone By, the Associated Press reports that the Library of Congress now has 2.5 million samples of recorded sound, everything from opera to presidential speeches to the sound of a steam locomotive. The National Archives and Records Administration has tens of thousands of hours of recordings they're trying to preserve in a project called Save Our Sounds. It's basically an acknowledgement that just like film, just like painting, photographs, even plain old artifacts and tools, sound is part of the cultural history of humanity and needs to be preserved. The library both collects extant recordings and has its own projects. Those include interviewing World War II veterans and collecting oral histories of different segments of the population. Apparently, they even have 12 hours of recollections from former slaves. Remember, Edison invented the phonograph in 1877. So 2 weeks ago, the Library of Congress dug into its massive archives and chose 50 sounds to inaugurate something called the National Recording Registry, a way to preserve and protect extra precious recordings, such as speeches by Kaiser Wilhelm, Buffalo Bill, President Roosevelt, Teddy, I mean, as well as FDR, and of course Thomas Edison reading Mary Had a Little Lamb. Well, I think this is a wonderful thing, and I'm all for preserving the sounds of a civilization. But of course, I also want to be a part of it. I'm sure Alan Freed or Dick Clark is in the library somewhere. Arthur Godfrey, Fred Allen, maybe Howard Stern, Cousin Brucey, or Joe Franklin interviewing Bing Crosby or Eddie Cantor. So I want to make my bid for posterity. Why shouldn't something positive like Dave's Gone By be on file at the National Registry alongside Hitler and Joseph McCarthy? But of course, that puts the burden on me. I don't want just any old excerpt from my show to represent me for all eternity. I want it to be special, something profound, something universal, and yet uniquely me. And I think I've come up with something special. It's short, it's very lo-fi, extremely elemental. I think it's something everyone can recognize and identify with. So without further ado, this is my submission to the Library of Congress Registry of Recorded Sound. Wow, there it is, posterity in the making. I call it sound of man moving very heavy sofa across the room, which I think everybody can relate to. What? My engineer is shaking his head. Well, dude, what did you think it was? Well, tell me later. I've got to move on with the news gone by. A French tourist and her sister were sunbathing on Miami Beach last week when they were run over by a police vehicle. Newsday reports that the cop was scouting a robbery suspect. He apparently didn't see the victims, nor did he have his siren on, and he just ran right over them. One of the women was killed, the other remains in critical condition. Their family in France wants to press charges against the police officer, fearing that he'll run over more people in the future. But Miami officials are calling for several months to investigate, allowing time for the inspectors to do their jobs. In the meantime, the officer is cooperating 80 to 90% of the time, allowing the inspectors to kick his tires but not look too deeply into his treads. In retail news, Australian scientists have invented a smart bra, a brassiere that tightens its own straps for more support during aerobic activity. The idea is to stop women's breasts from bouncing when they move. Having finished the non-jiggling bra, the same scientists are now working on taking the taste out of food, the mystery out of travel, and the comfort out of religion. Speaking of women, dietitian Cynthia Finley of the Johns Hopkins Weight Management Center has given the lie to the common belief that chocolate, chili peppers, and raw oysters work as stimulants to sexual appetite. There's no proof to it, said Finley, no conclusive evidence that any of these foods work as aphrodisiacs. She added that exercise and a healthy diet were far more conducive to sexual drive and performance than these foods. Other scientists agreed, although several of her male colleagues pointed out one exception. However unhealthy, a good old-fashioned hot dog can work wonders on a man's libido, provided the woman eating the frankfurter swallows it whole and doesn't spit out the mustard. In news that means absolutely nothing to anyone listening to this program, Forbes released its annual list of the world's richest humans. Microsoft honcho Bill Gates is still number one, although his net worth is way down this year. Back in 1998, he was worth over $100 billion. Now he's down to a measly $40.7 billion. I don't know. Blame the corporate dividends tax. Thank God President Bush wants to do away with it. It is just yanking the food right out of Gates' mouth, or at least the silver spoon it's on. Now, it should be said, in fact, the Associated Press did say it, that Gates is the world's biggest donator to charities. He gives more than $1 billion to medical research each year. So, after he cures cancer, then we can kill him. Other people on the Forbes billionaire list include Oprah Winfrey, the first black woman ever to make the cut, and there are 474 others whose combined wealth is 1.4 trillion kazoolies. But that's down a trillion and a half from last year. Forbes editor Louisa Kroll says, "You see, the poor economies are wreaking havoc on their finances like everyone else. They're not immune." Aww. Let's all the rest of us chip in and buy them the world's tiniest violin. Oh, what the hell, maybe a silk hanky to catch those teardrops. But in related and unrelated news, Newsday reports that Nassau County's budget crunch is now focusing on police department salaries. County Executive Thomas Swazi wants to put a salary freeze on cops, whose pay on Long Island rivals the best wages anywhere in the country. Average pay for a policeman here tends to run just over $100,000, with overtime able to push that up another $10,000 to $20,000. Lord knows, property taxes have gone up to maintain these six-figure salaries. And of course, Nassau finances are a disaster where you have terrible debt. But $100,000 is not Gatsby money anymore. You've got people on the Forbes list earning $10 million a year in interest. So it's weird to begrudge policemen who put their lives on the line for making a salary that basically allows them a house, a car, a kid in college, and a small vacation. Hell, $100,000 barely leaves enough for donut and plunger money. But seriously, I don't know what the answer is. maybe a small cost of living increase every year instead of big contractual leaps. But across the board, wage freezes are a bad idea, I think. It takes away motivation, it's bad for morale, and if people are spending more on heating oil, gas, food, whatever, while not making more for the same job, they're just not going to want to do the same job. I don't know about you, but I don't want a bunch of cops running around who make Andy Sipowicz look jolly by comparison. Now, some public television news. It's official. EBC, the Educational Broadcasting Corporation, which owns WNET, Channel 13, now also owns WLIW, Channel 21. Critics worry that the merger, which took a year and a half to finalize, will effectively make EBC a public TV monopoly and adversely affect local programming. For their part, the company promises that both stations will remain individual entities and that LIW will have more local coverage rather than less. There will be some combined formats, however, with some of Channel 13's franchise programs tailored especially for a Long Island audience. For example, the characters on Sesame Street will now spend most of their days shopping at Sesame Mall. Instead of diving into the sea with waterproof cameras, the explorers of Nova will sit on the Long Island Railroad and scream at each other on cell phones. And Charlie Rose will now conduct all his interviews from nail salons. And you know, I had one other joke in there that I wrote early in the week. It was a cheap shot about Mr. Rogers, that he would turn rude and trade his cardigan sweater for expensive jewelry and a fake tan. And little did I know when I wrote that line that 2 days later, news would come and we'd lose him. Fred Rogers, age 74, dead of stomach cancer.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Would you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please won't you be my neighbor?
Well, yes. I mean, what can you say? A truly gentle man, possibly a saintly one, a Presbyterian minister, a family man, a grandpa, healthy in mind and body, he swam every day, and he only makes it to 74. I wonder if Fred Rogers is on his way to heaven now and thinking, gee, God, if I'd known I'd still die relatively young, I would have been a little nasty. I mean, when friends got in my face for autographs, I could have pushed them aside once or twice. Or when Betty Aberlin was on the rag, I could have put her in her place now and then. I didn't have to be so perfect. I mean, it's not as if it bought me time. But, of course, Mr. Rogers didn't think that way. From all accounts, he was pretty much the same in real life as he was on TV. Oh, sure, he was a savvy businessman, and he probably ruled his TV show with an iron fist in a feather glove. But it seems no one who came in contact with Fred Rogers, the TV star or the man, had anything less than, forget nice things to say about him, it was like coming into contact with a truly spiritual and loving soul. Unfortunately, I never met him, but I watched him, I think from the very beginning, not when he started out in Pittsburgh, but when he came to public television here. And it's not as if my childhood home life was tumultuous or especially difficult. I didn't need to escape into Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. But I like visiting, the calm purposefulness of his routine. Come in, change the sweater and the shoes, say hello, feed the fish, talk a little, greet Mr. McFeely, the speedy delivery guy. And I didn't realize Fred Rogers' real middle name was McFeely, Fred McFeely Rogers. Anyway, he'd go to town, he'd meet the music guy or the chef. Remember Chef Rocket? I want quiet in my kitchen. The only man in the world whose singing voice made Harvey Fierstein sound like Pavarotti. And then Mr. Rogers would take an 8mm film, put it in a little slot, and there'd be a very short documentary, and then it was off to the world of make-believe, and X the Owl was my favorite, probably because he was really mellow and the closest to Rogers. The way Kermit the Frog and Ernie and Rolf on the Muppets were close to Jim Henson. And it never occurred to me that Fred was doing the voice, not just of X and King Friday, I figured that, but of Lady Elaine and Daniel Striped Tiger and, of course, Henrietta Pussycat Meow. A lot actually happened on every show, but it was never hurried. Everything unfolded at a pace you could handle. And then his shoes were back on, and he was out the door. But he'd be back when the day was new, and he'd have more ideas for us and things he'd want to talk about, and did. And, of course, the songs. I used to have his record album called You Are Special, and there was a big mirror on the cover, because with Mr. Rogers, it was all about his seeming to take a personal interest in you, which made you feel good about you. Remember, you know, you are my friend, you are special, you are my friend, you're special to me. I mean, he wasn't Oscar Hammerstein, but as a real musician, he could put together a song more memorable than most Broadway composers of his day. It's you I like, da-da-da-da-da, you know, and then there's this next one that I didn't even get into until later life, but it's just so perfectly infantile and perfectly sublime.
Tree, tree, tree.
Sorry about the audio quality on that. It's downloaded from the PBS.org website, and they have over a dozen Mr. Rogers songs there. Kind of low-quality real audio, but the site is great, as befits a great man. And it's terrific to have these songs readily available. That, of course, was Tree, Tree, Tree. You don't get more basic than that, but that's all you really need to say. Trees are about as beautiful and perfect a thing as you'll find on this earth. So why not a simple song saying how great they are? And I'm not really grieving for Mr. Rogers now, only because I kind of did a few months ago. I remember flipping across the TV dial and seeing a documentary tribute to him and really jumping out of my skin thinking, oh my God, he died? Mr. Rogers died? And he hadn't. It was just a tribute show honoring his career. But the show was so heartfelt, and his graciousness, his goodness, came through so strongly that I choked up anyway, which is my way of saying,
there are many ways to say I love you. There are many ways to say I care about you. Many ways, many ways, many ways to say I love you. There's the cooking way to say I love you. There's the cooking something someone really likes to eat. The cooking way, the cooking way, the cooking way to say I love you. There's the eating way to say I love you. There's the eating something someone made especially. I love you. are many ways to say I love you. Just by being there when things are sad and scary. Just by being there. Being there. Being there to say I love you. You'll find many ways.
Gone By from March 3rd, 2003. Please send your comments, opinions, and meow meow love letters meow to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Won't you please, won't you be my neighbor? Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's time to get a little cultural. This was in the New York Post last week. Attorney General Elliot Spitzer's office has demanded that local sports, theater, and arts venues stop charging fees on top of regular ticket prices. Legal action could be launched against those who don't comply. Spitzer's assistant, Elizabeth Block, wrote, quote, "Whether the fee is called a facilities fee, restoration fund charge, convenience charge, handling fee, or service fee, charging any additional fee, however denominated, is a violation of New York's Arts and Cultural Affairs law," unquote. The letters were sent to Madison Square Garden, Radio City, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, Nassau Coliseum, the Jones Beach Theater, and to Broadway theaters. State law says you can't charge anything more than the established price of the ticket, otherwise you're scalping. But as anyone going to Broadway shows knows, on top of the $90 you're paying for 2 hours of entertainment, on top of the $5 they get you for using Ticketmaster or Telecharge, you're also tagged an extra dollar or more per ticket just for entering the building. Theater owners claim they need the money for maintenance and upgrading. Sure, they get rent from producers, but only when the venue is booked. A Broadway theater, which, let's face it, could make a lot more money on that land as an office building or a shopping center, a theater can sit for months unused, collecting nothing but dust. On the other hand, when a show is booked, theaters do get rent and the cut of the box office. So, judging by the tight seats, inadequate bathrooms, and general discomfort levels of a lot of Broadway houses, where's that extra money really going? The service charge didn't hit Broadway until Garth Drabinsky, desperately over budget on Ragtime, realized he could make a little much-needed cash. Citing the fact that he just built the brand-new Ford Center for the Performing Arts, he tacked on a fee without actually making it part of the already high ticket cost. The late 90s revival of The Sound of Music at the Drew Jamson-owned Martin Beck Theater did it next, and then some of the Schubert theaters went for the fee, and finally the Nederlanders couldn't resist either. So, first of all, is this dishonest? Are they basically hijacking theatergoers who are committed to seeing a show at a certain high price, and then, at the last minute, saying, throw us an extra buck or two, what's an extra couple of quarters out of your pocket? The fee isn't hidden, per se. But it does feel like, for example, paying $100 to get into a safari park. You can bring in your car, but if you want to park it, you're charged another $6 or $7 to use the lot. And then, before they let you out, you're forced to tip the janitor $2 for cleaning up the elephant's peanut shells. I believe it's possible the restoration fee was initially conceived with a legitimate aim of putting it towards one thing, improving the condition of these landmark buildings. But whether that's been the follow-through, I don't know. And whether it's right to charge a toll to get that money, I really don't know. Helping me sort out my ambivalence on this is my guest by phone, Mr. Richmond Shepherd. If that name sounds familiar, it's because he was a radio theater critic in New York for many years. He's also the co-publisher of Performing Arts Insider magazine, which you'll hear about in a little bit, but he's even done more than that. He's an actor, a director, a producer, and for a while he even owned a chain of theaters on the West Coast. So I think Richmond is uniquely qualified to comment on all this, because he's done theater from all different angles, most especially as producer and landlord. I want to thank Richmond for taking a few minutes to chat with me tonight. Hey, Rich.
How are you?
I am great. How are you doing?
Well, I'm fine. You know, my newest theatrical endeavor, of course, is my improv troupe, New York Talk, N-O-O-Y-A-W-K-T-A-W-K, that performed at the Village Gate for 3 years, and people went on to stardom from it, and now we're getting ready to open soon.
Well, first of all, who went on to stardom from New York Talk?
Mark Kudish, who starred in several Broadway shows, Kim Sia, who starred in Smokey Joe's on Broadway and on the road, and Deborah Wilson, who was a star of Mad TV and game shows, and all they came out of the original New York Talk.
Now, when is your next one happening?
We're going to be starting to perform in a couple of weeks. We're just practicing doing improvs.
Do you know the venue yet?
There's three of them. We're going to be at the Soho Playhouse briefly. We'll probably be in the Cutting Room. We might be at Ha. We're going to try a few of the comedy rooms, and then the next step will be to find a permanent venue like we did at the Village Gate, which no longer exists, of course.
Right. Well, good luck, certainly, on
you.
That.
And now, about this ticket stuff, it's interesting. What it really is, see, they can charge whatever they want Broadway shows. For instance, when the producers opened, they were charging $90 a seat. When the reviews were as good as they were for the producers, they immediately raised the price to $100 a seat.
Right. But that was the actual basic charge of the ticket.
Yes. Now, what this is the equivalent of is stores charging $899 for something. You know, a television set for $399.
Right.
Rather than saying $400. When you get to the tax, it's really much higher than that. It's not saying we're charging you 91 and a quarter, which is what they're really doing, because the money does go into their pocket. Is saying, oh, you're getting your ticket for only $90. It's a mind screw. You know what I'm saying?
But not actually illegal or dishonest. It's just a way of spreading it around.
It's a way of pretending that they're charging less than they're charging, because the money, of course, goes to them.
But it
is a kind of dishonesty in a way.
And you keep using the broad term they.
Yeah.
Remember that this extra charge.
The producers set the price.
But they don't. That's the thing. The producers don't get a cut of this fee.
The other way around. See, in many of the shows, the theater owners are co-producers, so they get it three ways. The theater owners will often, you'll see their name at the top on the playbill saying Nita Landers and Joe Smith and Helen Jones present, or Helen Jones, Jim Smith, and the Schuberts present. Well, that means that the theater owners are putting up the theater as an investment in the show. Now, the theater not only gets rent,
right,
extremely high, he also gets a percentage of the gross.
Right, well.
To add on a surcharge, he's getting it from three places.
The theater owner, the theater owner is, but is the, I guess if they're also the producer, they are.
Exactly.
They're not
exactly
always the producer.
They are very often part of the package of producers if you look at the top of your playbill. Now, sometimes it's a straight rental, and the rent that the theater owner charges the producer is, I don't have the figures for Broadway. I have them for off-Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And it can be anywhere from, for a mid-sized house, from $5,000 to $12,000 a week for these mid-sized off-Broadway houses.
Do they sometimes waive anything during rehearsals or during the previews, or they make a deal?
Every deal is separate. Yes, you can do any. If the guy has no customers, you can offer him whatever, you know, whatever you can. Everything is negotiable. But to add on the surcharge is it's a lie in a way, because...
So do you think they should just raise the price?
If they're going to charge a certain price, let them charge a price. Let them raise. If they want to raise the rent a little bit, let them raise it. They're getting a percentage of the gate anyway, the theater owners.
Now, you were a theater... You own several theaters.
I built, owned, and operated five small theaters in Los Angeles on Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
and it's now called Theater Row, because when I opened my theaters, half a dozen other theaters opened nearby.
Uh-huh.
So it became a theater community there with common concerns, including parking and things like that.
Right.
One of the major differences in theater in New York and Los Angeles is that in L.A., if you have a theater with more than a certain number of seats, you have to have one parking place for every five seats.
Yeah, but in L.A., it's spread out enough. You can do that, or...
Well, it depends on the neighborhood and where it is, but that's a concern you don't have if you open a theater in New York.
Oh, I see.
Well, one parking place for every five seats.
Were you Equity?
It was called Equity Waiver.
Mm-hmm.
On theaters of 99 seats or less, Equity waived its jurisdiction. This is so that actors could have showcases.
So it's sort of like off Broadway.
Well, if you see some of the operations that there are, they're like the Tiffany Theater or the Odyssey Theater, which are big, beautiful 99-seat theaters with spacious lobbies and luxurious...
Wait, the Odyssey's only 99?
They got three theaters in there, 99 each.
Oh, okay.
And they are beautiful theaters, just like the Tiffany on the Sunset Strip. They can make deals with actors. In other words, they're not required by Equity to pay them. My deal at my theaters was the actors got 50% of the profits to split among them.
And was there generally profit in a 99-cent theater? Was it
99-seat theater?
Yeah, no, it's not cents, 99-seat theater.
Well, let's say you're charging, let's say you have a show running at the Tiffany, you're charging, let's say, $40 a seat.
Okay.
Okay, 100 seats times 40 is how much?
4,000, something like that?
Per performance times 8?
32,000.
A week.
Okay, but minus everything.
Well,
here in New York, the everything kills you, you know.
I know. The advertising is much cheaper in L.A. The production costs are much cheaper. Yes, you can make quite a bit of money in a 99-seat theater in L.A. But in L.A., it all depends on, similar to New York, the Review and the Times.
Mm.
But in L.A., to have a success in a smaller theater, you need to get not only a good review with a photograph in the L.A. Times, you also need to get be picked as pick of the week by the critic.
Now,
and in New York...
well, you need the Times.
I need the Times to recognize you.
Yeah.
I produced a show, directed it also, about Lord Buckley a few years ago, starring Tom Calagna, and we got a rave review in the Daily News from Howard Kissel with a photograph.
Uh-huh.
The kind of review from the Daily News, it brought in six people. It's the same review in the Times would have brought in 6,000. Theater is totally dependent on the review in the Times. And by the way, I don't know if you know that the cost of an ad in the New York Times
is, of what size?
Is absurd. For
what?
1 inch, it's the show we just did. It was $559. Per inch, if you're less than 200 seats. And if you're more than 200 seats, it's, what is it, 750, isn't it?
It is something like that.
For
you're
inch?
Getting a break because it's live theater. If it were another thing, it would be
no,
more.
No, not because it's live theater, because it's smaller live theater. Right. The mid-sized houses have to pay something like 750 an inch,
right.
which we were talking last night about opening a show. There's a play by the guy, Terry, I can't remember his last name. He wrote Killer Joe. It's Scott Glenn and Amanda Plummer.
Tracy Letts, you mean?
Huh?
Tracy Letts. Yeah.
Tracy Letts, we did a reading last night of Bug.
Okay.
A play by Tracy Letts. And it's an amazing show. Very strange. Trailer people once again. And considering doing it.
But...
Well, it's probably going to be none, but we're talking about the cost of doing it, say, in a mid-sized house, in a 200-seat theater. The budget is $300,000. And then Scott Murphy, who's producer, said, well, you know, maybe we'll do it in a storefront for $150,000.
Yeah.
And that's in a storefront theater, you know, with 74 seats, which is the limit for
right.
being public assembly in New York. So I said, well, at least if you do it in a storefront theater for $150,000, if the reviews are, it costs you $50,000 till you open, if the reviews are terrible, you give back the other $100,000, and they've only lost one-third of their money. But, of course, you need that $100,000 to advertise and publicize the show.
Yeah. I mean, it all gets so, and even in New York orally, it all gets so complicated with that.
It all depends on the advertising and publicity. I have produced four people showcases in New York at nice little theaters like the 29th Street Rep, or even at American Theater of Actors on 54th Street.
Right. But
so anyway, adding that you wanted to go back to the surcharge.
Well, yeah, final comment on that.
Final comment is it's an advertising ploy. They are really raising the ticket price and pretending that they're not. I think they should either raise the ticket price or not. If they want to raise it to $92.50 instead of $90, use the money for whatever they want. The theater owners are getting their cut anyway.
Okay. Well, Richmond, thank you for...
Did I ramble on too much?
No, we're great.
The tape's running
out. Yeah, I have to take a break. So thank you again for talking about all this. Best of luck on all the shows that you're doing, all your endeavors. It's 8:37 p.m., and I'm going to stay cultural for a bit. Just wanted to make a comment about the last interview. I know we were talking about the fees and the theaters and all that going on. What everybody's looking at right now is the war between the League of American Theaters and the Musicians Union over whether to use live musicians and how many musicians and working out their contract deal. The latest on that is they've extended the contract deadline, which was going to be midnight tonight, to Thursday midnight. So everybody keeping an eye on that. For at least a few more days, there's going to be live musicians in the orchestras at all the Broadway musicals. After Thursday, if they don't work it out, the producers could indeed opt for completely electronic, non-live orchestras. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, staying cultural, with a look at all things artful and entertaining, one of the residual effects of the great blizzard of 03 for me was a backache. I didn't get it the day after I shoveled. In fact, I was still getting over a cold when we had the big snowstorm that dumped a foot and a half on the island. So imagine my surprise when, after I finally dispensed with my head cold, a week after the storm, I got hit with lower back pain. I went to sleep with it bad and woke up with it in the morning worse. So my wife and I toddled off to the doctor, who kindly renewed my prescription to Vioxx, a marvelous little drug if I do say so myself, and within a couple of hours, it made all the difference. But for about 3 days, I was still pretty much out of commission. Not immobile or in constant agony, but in some distress. So what's there to do but lie in bed and read? And I grabbed a book I bought secondhand a few months ago, and talk about a wise choice. I figured I needed a laugh, something light, and that's what I got from Groucho and Me, the 1959 autobiography of Groucho Marx. And he takes pains to stress that the book is written by him. No ghostwriters, no as told to. This is Groucho, on his honor, telling his life story, anecdotally to be sure. It's a life of comic incidents, or some events that were frightful when they happened, but funny in retrospect. It's easy to see where Groucho got his reputation for being tight with a dollar, not just because he lost a quarter of a million of them in the stock market crash. Other performers did much worse. But it goes back to his childhood. He once had a hot date ruined because the girl asked for a 10-cent candy, which was 10 cents more than he had budgeted for the evening, and as soon as they left the movies, they stepped into a downpour with no money for a streetcar. Funny, the girl was just not terribly understanding about it. And there are loads of reminiscences like that about Groucho and his brothers, Chico hawking possessions to pay debts, but also winning much-needed cash at the pool hall, Harpo's futile attempts to keep a job, their dad's inability to cut a suit properly, even though he was a tailor, and young Groucho's miserable luck with automobiles, girls, and vaudeville acts. It's all recounted very breezily, occasionally laugh-out-loud funny. he comes across as a nicer guy than people say he was in person, yet you can read through the lines at his quirks and neuroses, plus his rather strong moral center. But I think my favorite piece in the book is just so quintessential Marx, Harpo as much as Groucho. And I'm just going to read an excerpt, and if your back is bothering you the way mine was bothering me, maybe this will align your spine like it did mine. It's from Chapter 12, called Some Clowning That Wasn't in the Act. We were playing a mangy vaudeville theater on the west side of New York. We always flirted with the girls in the audience, no matter what scene we were playing. And I must say, with a minimum of modesty, they almost invariably flirted back. This particular night, there were two very attractive girls sitting in the upper box. They didn't seem to be particularly interested in the events taking place on the stage, and at the moment, neither were we. They were quite a distraction. They were trying to tell us, by frantic signaling, that they were not only desirous of meeting Harpo and me, but were also trying to indicate to us where to meet them. Whether it was because we weren't very clever at reading signs, or because they were inept at sending them out, we weren't making the contact that was necessary to consummate the rendezvous. Luckily, Harpo is a master of pantomime, and he finally got through to them. By some fancy finger-waving, he instructed them to write their names and addresses on a piece of paper. As is customary at the end of the act, the chiton came down, and we gave those hammy smiles that all actors assume when bowing and scraping to the audience. As the curtain went up again, Harpo, to our surprise, went up with it. As the chiton reached the upper box, he perilously hung on with one hand, and with the other, reached toward the box. One of the girls quickly handed him a piece of paper containing all the necessary information. Harpo and I swiftly removed most of our makeup. We always left some of it on so that people would know we were actors. We donned our street clothes, and soon we were on our way along 8th Avenue. It was now almost midnight. As we walked along, we came upon a lone pushcart peddler who was just about to close up for the night. In desperation, he had stuck a sign on the wagon which read, "Selling out. Take these 4 dozen oranges home for 40 cents." I guess we were sorry for the peddler, or perhaps it was one of our more lunatic moments, or maybe it was just that we couldn't resist a bargain, but we were now on our way to a romantic rendezvous, not with candy, flowers, perfume, or any of the normal gifts that girls expect from their gentlemen callers, but with 48 oranges. When we arrived at their apartment, the girls emitted little squeals of delight on spying our 4 bulky bags. I don't know what they thought we had brought in them. Certainly they didn't expect jewels or expensive clothing to be packed in brown paper bags. Reluctant to keep them in suspense any longer, we quickly opened the sacks and displayed with pride our 4 dozen oranges. The room was fairly large, with a bed on either side of it. I separated 24 oranges from their mates and bowled them over to one end of the room. Harpo then proceeded to bowl his share to the other end of the room. I don't know who started it, Harpo or his girl, but as I turned away, an orange clipped me on the back of my head. I quickly retreated behind one of the beds, picked up one of my oranges, and caught Harpo's girl square in the small of her back. Harpo, bristling with chivalry, picked one up and scored a bullseye on my girl. By that time, he and his girlfriend were barricaded behind the bed on their side of the room, and it now became open warfare. The girls quickly got into the spirit of things and demonstrated a deadly marksmanship of their own. For some curious reason, love had flown out the window. It now became a question of survival. It was trench warfare all over again. It was the Maginot Line with oranges. The fruit was flying thick and fast, and in 30 minutes, the room was a shambles. Furniture was overturned, a layer of orange peel and juice covered the carpet, and the neighbors were pounding on the walls and shouting, "Cut out the racket, or we'll send for the police." As the oranges became mushier, they became too difficult to handle, and the firing gradually ceased. At that moment, the front door opened, and the landlord entered. He didn't say much, but we quickly gathered that we had worn out our welcome. Grabbing our hats, without so much as a goodbye to the girls, we made a hasty exit. The landlord's foot just missed me by 3 inches. Harpo wasn't that lucky. That was the end of our orange period. No love, no nothing, and our 40-cent investment shot to hell. Groucho Marx from his Groucho and Me, the most recent reprinting done in paperback by Da Capo Press in 1995. And sorry if my cadence offers only a poor approximation of Groucho. Here's the real thing.
I'm awfully glad you came, Miss Kennedy.
That's all right, madam. At a party like this, you've got to have the law around. Now, a nice woman like you needs protection. And I'm here to see that you get it. There's a couple of shady characters hanging around that I'm going to keep an eye on. What's that you gave him?
I don't give it up to you.
You give me that to me.
Give it up to
me. Give me that, I tell you.
I'm not to tell you.
Who got my shirt? What's become of my shirt? I want my shirt.
Hey, you've lost your shirt.
Yes.
Can you describe this shirt?
What's that?
Now look, this cross marks the spot where the shirt was last seen.
Cut that out.
Now remain quiet, will you please?
Just as I thought. You birds are all in on this thing, and you're all trying to keep me from finding my shirt.
That's a lie, you whelp.
I want my shirt.
He wants his shirt.
I want my shirt.
He wants his shirt.
His shirt. He wants his shirt.
I want my shirt. He wants my shirt. I want my shirt. I want my shirt. I'm happy without my shirt.
He wants his shirt. He wants his shirt.
Know what Long Island is doing Friday nights? No, not that. Long Island's Dating, a show for singles by that very singular personality, Bonnie D. Graham. Bonnie talks live with callers and guests about all facets of singlehood, sex, health, relationships, and sex. Bonnie's a comedian and TV host, so whatever your habitational status, check out Long Island's Dating Friday nights at 6 on WGBB.
Arafat.
Howdy, this is Yasser Arafat.
You can be Ramallah.
Coming to you from beautiful downtown Ramallah.
Dave's gone by.
And you're listening to Dave's Gone By.
I'm on WGBB
on WGBB AM 1240 Freeport. Who stole my goat? Five-thirty Saturday nights. It's a new spin on old-fashioned radio when Don Lewis hosts Entertainment Long Island. It's an hour of interviews and advice about how to get started as a performer, be it as a career or a hobby. Every show has nostalgia, humor, and live music by Eddie Hug and the Moonshiners. So catch the corny jokes and talented folks on Entertainment Long Island, 5:30 Saturdays on WGBB, because the stage is a world of entertainment. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's 8:49 p.m., time for a sports update. At the end of the third quarter, it's 34-9, Tampa Bay over the Raiders. Unlikely that Oakland will turn things around in the last 15 minutes, but stranger things have happened. Remember that Dave's Gone By is the only place you can hear the Super Bowl score 4 weeks after the Super Bowl. And yes, you can sponsor our weekly Super Bowl update. Just call 516-295-1511, and you can put your name or company name to such exciting scores as 3-3, 13-3, 34-15, and the very popular 47-15. So be part of one of our most popular segments on Dave's Gone By, the Super Bowl score, brought to you by you. Now, before we wrap up this very full edition of Dave's Gone By, I want to give a birthday nod to Louis Furbank, best known as Lou Reed. The legendary singer-songwriter turns 59 today, born March 2nd, 1944. And we talked about Groucho Marx being occasionally difficult to live with and irascible, but he was Mr. Rogers compared to Lou Reed. Even if only half the stories in Victor Bachris's biography Transformer are half true, Lou has been an impossible character from the beginning and has only mellowed a little over the years. He's been addictive, abusive, unreliable, unapproachable, unfathomable. At one point or another, every drop of blood in his body had to be transfused and detoxified, and he's left a trail of bitterness and sarcasm 10 miles wide.
And yet people who've been burned by him continue to work with him, and people who might just as soon revile him forgive him, because he is Lou Reed, and everything that means. And because the parts of him that are special and good are not only redemptive, but often touched by genius. And while it's been tempting to write off a lot of the stuff he's done in the last decade or so, either because it's pretentious or he talks more than he sings or whatever reason, if you give the later albums their due, there's actually some amazing stuff on them. I haven't heard his new one. It's a 2-CD set adapting Edgar Allan Poe stories and other tales of macabre despair. Reviews have ranged between guardedly positive and quite dismissive, but I'll bet you there's at least 3 or 4 major numbers on it. And the same goes for his previous album, Ecstasy. Kind of came and went without much fanfare, possibly because so many of the songs are fairly explicit, either in language or about sexuality. He hasn't been this direct, down, and dirty since his Street Hassle days. But Reed has also found this grungy guitar sound that he can just get lost in, and so can the listener. It's a really wonderful, heavy, distortion-filled, amplified guitar clamor and swell. There's an 18-minute song on Ecstasy that plays the same riff over and over and over, and it doesn't even get boring, well, until the 14th minute or so. Reed has always been a connoisseur of audio sound, and he's invariably been disappointed that the technology available hasn't allowed him to hit that Nirvana note. Maybe he's found it now. Sure sounds like it. But anyway, I'm not going to play the 18-minute song here, even if I had the time. The F-word rears its ugly head, and remember, this isn't public access. But I'll play a quieter song off the Ecstasy album, a really marvelous and concise postcard of the blush of youth, the heat of lust, the blindness of rage, the pangs of regret, and the sighs of acceptance. Here's Lou Reed, So Helpless.
When I think of you, Baton Rouge, I think of a mariachi band. I think of 16 and a crisp green football field. I think of the girl I never had. When I think of you, Baton Rouge, I think of a backseat in a car. Windows are foggy and so are we, as the police ask for our ID. So helpless, so helpless, ooh, so helpless, ooh, so helpless, ooh, so helpless, so helpless. Well, I once had a car, lost it in a divorce. The judge was a woman, of course. She said, give her the car and the house and your taste, or else. I set the trial date. So now when I think of you, Baton Rouge, and the deep southern bells with their touch, I wonder where love ends and hate starts to blush. In the fields, in the swamps, in the rush, in the terracotta cobwebs of your mind, when did you start seeing me as a spider spinning web of malicious intent? And you as poor, poor me, at the fire, at the joint, the dislocated broken mount, in the bedroom, in the house where we were unmarried. So helpless, so helpless, so helpless, so helpless, so helpless, so helpless. When was I the villain in your heart, putting the brake on your start? You slapped my face and cried and screamed, that's what marriage came to mean, the bitterest ending of a dream. You wanted children, and I did not. Was that what it was all about? You might get a laugh when you hear me shout. You might get a laugh when you hear me shout. I wish I had. So helpless, Sometimes when I think of Baton Rouge, I see us with 2.5 strapping sons, 1.5 flush daughters preparing to marry, and 2 fat grandsons I can barely carry. Daddy, uncle, family gathers there for grace. A dog in a barbecue pit goes up in space. The dream recedes in the morning with a bad aftertaste. And I'm back in the big city, worn from the race of the chase. What a waste. So thanks for the cause, the announcement of child. And I must say, you and Sam look great. Your daughter's gleaming in that white wedding dress with pride. Sad to say, I can never bring that to you, that white smile. So I try not to think of Baton Rouge or of a Mari Archiband or of 16 and a Chris Green football field. And the girl, I never had. So helpless, so helpless, so helpless, so helpless, so helpless.
Lou Reed from his 2000 release Ecstasy. The song is called Baton Rouge. Really good album. I keep getting more and more into it. And if you'd like to see a playlist of the music on this and previous episodes of Dave's Gone By, just visit our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. We've got pictures, amusing asides, and information on how to purchase cassettes of previous Dave's Gone By episodes. The website also tells how to advertise or sponsor segments on the show, and information about how to join the Bystanders Club. It's still only $10, and you get all the cool stuff, including an autographed photo, a bi-monthly newsletter, and, of course, the best of audio cassette. Log on to our website for the details, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. If you forget the URL, just Google search Dave's Gone By, and we're right up top. A couple of reminders, WGBB is the place to hear some other cool programs on the weekend. Long Island's Dating with Bonnie D. Graham, Fridays at 6, Entertainment Long Island, hosted by Don Lewis with live country, folk, and bluegrass music by Eddie Hug and the Moonshiners, Saturdays at 5:30, Joe Salzone Live with conservative but lively political talk, Saturday nights at 7:30, and of course, the gang of Teen America right before me, Sunday nights at 6:30. And here's another reminder, perhaps the most important one of all. And you'll recognize this voice.
It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. It's such a happy feeling. You're growing inside. And when you wake up, ready to say, I think I'll make a happy bed. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends. So you can always help to make each day a special day by just your being yourself. You grow in your own way. Everyone does. That's one reason each one of us is different and special. And people can like us exactly as we are.
Time for some thank yous. Thank you, Station Manager Joey, Engineer Joe, and Engineer Paul. Thank you, Richmond Shepherd, for your expertise. Thank you to my wife, Joyce, for her help and suggestions. Thank you, Lou Reed, for your music. And thank you, Mr. Rogers, for being our neighbor. And thank all of you for tuning in to Dave's Gone By. This was our 22nd episode, Forward March. And may March bring us better weather, better news, and better days. And I hope to bring you even better Daves. So tune in next week and every week, Sunday nights at 7:30 on WGBB AM 1240 and WGBB.com. Until next week, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Meow, meow, God bless, meow. And gone by.